Encountering the beauty of a visible body and using it as a kind of instrument of memory, he embraces and loves it. And being together with it and rejoicing is kindled all the more in his understanding. Such men, while still here in the body, do not sit yearning for and marveling at this light alone. Nor, once they have arrived there after death, do they turn back here again and, running off like fugitives, roll about at the doorways of newlyweds and in bedchambers, those wretched little phantoms of pleasure-loving and body-loving men and women who are not rightly called lovers at all. For the man who is truly a lover, once he has arrived there and has consorted with the beautiful, as is right, is winged and initiated, and continues on high, dancing and circling about his own god, until he comes once more to the meadows of the moon and Aphrodite, and, falling asleep there, begins another birth. But these matters, he said, call for a larger discussion than we have time for now. Yet this too belongs to love, as to the other gods. As Euripides says, to rejoice in being honored by men, and the opposite as well. For he is most gracious to those who receive him harmoniously, but heavy upon those who behave arrogantly toward him. Neither does Zeus, the god of strangers, pursue wrongs done to strangers and suppliants, nor Zeus, the god of birth, avenge a parent's curses, as swiftly and readily as love answers the call of lovers who have been treated with contempt, a punisher of the ill-bred and the arrogant. What indeed could one say of Euxenthetis, and of Leucomantes in Cyprus, who is still even now called the peeping woman? But perhaps you have not heard of the punishment of Gorgo the Cretan, who suffered something similar to the peeping woman, except that the latter was turned to stone as she peeped out to watch her lover being carried out for burial, whereas in Gorgo's case, a certain Asander fell in love with her, a young man of decent character and brilliant birth, though he had come down from brilliant circumstances to humble and mean ones. Even so, he was disdained by no one, and being a kinsman, he asked for Gorgo, who, on account of her wealth, was, it seems, much fought over and much courted as his wife, having many good men joined with him in wooing her, and having won over all the girl's guardians and relatives. Further, as for the causes and origins of love that people speak of, they are peculiar to neither sex but common to both. For indeed the images that enter into those in love, running through them, stirring up and titillating the body's mass, slipping down together with the other configurations into seed, is this possible from boys but impossible from women? And these beautiful, sacred remembrances of that divine, true, Olympian beauty, by which the soul grows its wings, what would prevent them from arising from boys and young men? And equally from girls and women, whenever a pure, well-ordered character becomes visible through the bloom and grace of the form, just as an upright shoe reveals the good shape of a foot. As Ariston used to say, whenever those skilled at perceiving such things discern, in beautiful forms and unspoiled bodies, bright, settled traces of a soul that is upright and unbroken. For it is not the case that the pleasure lover, when asked whether he inclines more toward the female or the male, and answering, wherever beauty is present, seemed to give an answer suited to his own desire, being, as it were, ambidextrous, while the lover of beauty and the noble man bases his loves not on beauty or good form as such, but on differences of anatomy. A lover of horses embraces the fine qualities of Podargus no less than those of Aethe, Agamemnon's mare. And a lover of hunting takes pleasure not only in male dogs, but also raises Cretan and Laconian bitches. But the lover of beauty and of humanity is not uniform or alike toward both sexes. Instead, he thinks, as if there were differences between garments, that there are differences between loving women and loving men. And yet they say that youthful bloom is the flower of virtue, while denying that the female sex can flower at all, or manifest any natural excellence in relation to virtue, which is absurd. Indeed, Aeschylus rightly wrote, "The burning eye of a young woman who has tasted a man will not escape my notice." So then, do the signs of a bold, unchaste, corrupted character run across the features of women, while no light of orderliness and prudence attaches to their form at all? Or does much indeed attach and show itself thereto, yet move nothing and call forth no love at all? Neither answer is reasonable or true. Rather, as has been shown, these things belong in common to both sexes alike, since the contest, so to speak, is a shared one. So Daphnius, Let us take up arms against those arguments which Zeuxippus went through just now, making love the same thing as unruly desire that carries the soul off toward licentiousness, not that I myself am so persuaded, but because I have often heard it said by difficult, loveless men. Some of these, dragging wretched little wives along with their dowries and money into household management and mean calculations, keep them constantly at hand, quarreling like yokemates day after day. Others, wanting children rather than wives, just as cicadas discharge their seed onto a squill or some such plant, likewise in haste beget offspring in whatever bodies happen to be at hand. And once they have gathered the fruit of it, let the marriage go its own way from then on, caring nothing whether it lasts or not, and not thinking it worthwhile either to love or to be loved. But to be cherished and to cherish, differing by a single letter from to shelter, seem to me to show at once an affection mixed, of necessity, with mere time and habit. But whomever love seizes and breathes into, he will first of all have no mine and not mine, as in Plato's ideal city, for it is not simply that friends' goods are held in common among everyone, but only among those who, though bounded by separate bodies, forcibly bring their souls together and fuse them, wishing to be not two but one, and believing themselves so. Then again, chastity between partners, which marriage needs above all. In most married people it comes more from outside, from the laws, than from willingness, being constrained by shame and fear the work of many bridles and rudders together, and it stands guard constantly over those who live together. But love has so great a share of self-control, order, and fidelity, that even if he ever touches a licentious soul, he turns it away from all its other lovers, cutting out its boldness, breaking its arrogance and unruliness, instilling shame, silence, and quiet, and clothing it in a decorous bearing, so that he makes it obedient to one alone. You know, I suppose, by report, that famous and much desired lies, how she used to set Greece ablaze with desire, indeed she was fought over by both seas. But when love touched her because of Hippolochus the Thessalian, she left behind Acrocorinth, washed by pale green water, and, fleeing secretly from her great host of other lovers, went off in modest fashion. There the women, out of envy and jealousy over her beauty, led her out to the temple of Aphrodite, stoned her, and killed her. Whence, it seems, they still call that shrine Aphrodite the Manslayer, even now. We know, too, of slave girls who flee their masters' embraces, and of commoners who look down on princesses, once they have taken love as master within their soul. For just as in Rome, they say, once the man called dictator has been proclaimed, those holding other offices lay them down. So too those in whom love has become established as lord are freed and released from every other master and ruler, and remain thereafter like temple slaves. And a noble woman joined to her lawful husband through love would rather endure the embrace of bears and serpents than the touch and bed of another man. Though there is no lack of examples for you, fellow initiates and devotees of the god, still it would not be right to pass over the story of Camma the Galatian. For she, being most striking in appearance, had been married to Sinatus the Tetrarch, when Sinorix, the most powerful of the Galatians, fell in love with her and killed Sinatus, since he could neither force nor persuade the woman while her husband lived. Camma's refuge and consolation for her grief was her ancestral priesthood of Artemis. She spent most of her time in the goddess's service, admitting no one, though many kings and potentates sought her hand. When, however, Sinorix ventured to approach her about marriage, she did not shrink from the attempt, nor did she reproach him for what had happened, on the ground that Sinorix had been driven to it by goodwill and longing for her, not by any other wickedness. So he came, trusting her, and asked for the marriage. She met him, greeted him warmly, and, leading him to the goddess's altar, poured a libation from a bowl of honeyed milk which, it seems, had been poisoned. Then, drinking off about half of it herself first, she handed the rest to the Galatian. And when she saw that he had drunk it, she cried out loudly in triumph, and, speaking the name of her dead husband, said, "This is the day, dearest husband, that I have waited for. Living apart from you until now, I lived in grief. But now receive me gladly, for I have taken vengeance on your behalf against the vilest of men, and have gladly become his partner in death, as I once was your partner in life." So Sinorix, being carried off in a litter, died a short time later, while Camma, having lived through that day and the following night, is said to have died very bravely and cheerfully. since many such things have happened both among us and among barbarians, who could tolerate those who slander Aphrodite, as though, when joined with love and present, she prevents friendship from coming into being. As for the union of male with male, or rather one might well say, on reflection, incontinence and assault, it is outrage, not Aphrodite, that brings this about. For this reason, we place those who take pleasure in submitting to it in the very worst class of vice, and grant them no share of fidelity, shame, or friendship. Truly, as Sophocles says of such friends, those who are deprived of them rejoice, while those who have them pray to escape them. But as for those who, not being bad by nature, were deceived or forced into yielding and giving themselves up, these continue for the rest of their lives to suspect and hate, more than anyone else, the men who so use them, and take bitter revenge whenever the chance is given. Critias killed Archelaus after having been his beloved, and Pythelaus killed Alexander of Phary. Periander, the tyrant of the Ambraciots, once asked his beloved whether he was not yet pregnant, and the boy, provoked, killed him. But for wedded wives, by contrast, such acts are the beginnings of friendship, like a shared participation in great mysteries. The pleasure involved is a small thing, but the honor, favor, mutual affection, and trust that grow from it day by day neither convict the Delphians of talking nonsense when they call Aphrodite harmony, nor Homer, when he calls such intercourse love union. It also bears witness that Solon proved himself the most expert lawgiver in matters of marriage when he ordained that a husband must approach his wedded wife not less than 3 times a month, not for pleasure's sake, one might ask. No, rather, just as cities from time to time renew their treaties with one another, so he wished the marriage likewise to be renewed, through such tokens of affection, against the vexations that build up on every occasion. But it will be said, many love affairs with women are base and mad. Well, are those with boys not even more so? Gazing with tender intimacy, the poet slipped into loving a beardless, soft-skinned, handsome youth, wishing to fasten himself to him and die, and so win an epitaph. But just as this is boy madness, so that other passion is woman madness, neither of them is love. It is absurd, then, to say that women have no share in virtue at all, or in any other excellence. Indeed, what need is there to speak of their prudence and understanding, and further their fidelity and justice, when even courage and boldness and greatness of soul have shown themselves plainly in many of them? To grant that their nature is fine in every other respect, yet to fault it and declare it unfit for friendship alone, is altogether outrageous. For indeed they are devoted to their children, devoted to their husbands, and altogether affectionate by nature. And, like fertile, receptive soil for friendship, they are found wanting neither in persuasiveness nor in charm. Just as poetry, by fitting to plain speech the sweeteners of melody, meter, and rhythm, makes its instructive element more moving and its harmful element less guarded against, so nature, by clothing woman with grace of appearance, persuasiveness of voice, and an attractive form of beauty, has, in the licentious woman, contributed greatly toward pleasure and deception, but in the chaste woman, toward a husband's goodwill and friendship. Plato, for his part, used to urge Xenocrates, who was in other respects a noble man and great, though very austere in character. Plato nevertheless urged him to sacrifice to the graces. And one might advise a good and sensible wife to sacrifice to Eros as well, so that he may dwell in the marriage kindly disposed and be sweet toward its concerns, and so that the husband, not drifting off toward some other woman, may not be forced to speak the words from comedy. What a wrong I do this woman, wretched man that I am! For to be loved in marriage is a greater good than merely to love. It frees one from many faults, or rather from all those that corrupt and ruin a marriage. As for the passionate, biting stage at the beginning, my dear Zeuxippus, do not fear it as though it were a wound or an itch. And yet even a kind of wound may be nothing terrible when it comes from growing together, like grafted trees, with a good woman. For a wounding is also the beginning of conception, since there is no mingling between things that have not been affected by one another. Learning, too, disturbs children when they begin it, and philosophy disturbs the young. But neither in them does the biting quality remain forever, nor does it in lovers. Rather, just as when liquids fall together there seems to be some seething and disturbance at first, so too Eros, once it has settled and been calmed by time, produces the most stable disposition of all. For this is truly what is called a blending, through and through, the blending of lovers. Whereas the union of those who merely live together in some other way resembles the contacts and interminglings described by Epicurus, full of collisions and reboundings, producing no such unity as love creates when it takes hold of a marital partnership. For there are no greater pleasures to be had from others, nor more constant needs met by others, nor is the beauty of friendship found elsewhere so glorious and enviable as when a husband and wife, of one mind in their thoughts, keep house together. Indeed, the law assists it, and nature shows that even the gods have need of shared begetting and of love. Thus the poets say that the earth loves the rain, and the sky loves the earth. The natural philosophers say that the moon loves the sun, and unites with it, and conceives. And that the earth, too, mother of men and of every animal and plant, would necessarily perish at some point, and be utterly quenched, once the gods' dread love or longing abandoned matter, and matter ceased desiring and pursuing from that source its origin and motion. But so that we may not seem to wander too far afield or talk sheer nonsense, you know how much is said about the instability of love for boys, and how people mock it, saying that their friendship, like an egg, can be split with a hair, that such lovers, like nomads, pitch camp for a season among those in bloom and flower, and then strike camp again as though from hostile territory. Still more crudely, the sophist Bion used to call the hairs of handsome boys Harmodiuses and Aristogitons, since by their growth lovers are freed at once from a beautiful tyranny. These charges, however, are not justly brought against genuine lovers. But what Euripides said is elegant. For he, embracing and warmly kissing the fair Agathon, already bearded, said that of fair men the autumn too is welcomed, the only season that grows gray in nothing, reaching its prime even with wrinkles, but remaining faithful all the way to tombs and monuments. And one could count few lasting unions born of love for boys, but countless born of love for women, sharing every trust together, faithfully and eagerly, to the very end. I wish to relate one thing that happened in our own time, under the Emperor Vespasian. Civiles, who stirred up the revolt in Gaul, had naturally enough many partners in the affair, among them Sabinus, a young man of no mean birth, but the most conspicuous of all in wealth and reputation. Having laid hold of great undertakings, they failed, and expecting to pay the penalty, some took their own lives, while others in flight were captured. For Sabinus, everything else made it easy enough to slip away and take refuge among the barbarians. But the wife he had taken, the best of all women, there they called her Impona, though in Greek one might name her Heroes, he could neither leave behind nor bring along with him. Now, having on his estate underground storerooms dug for his money, of which only two of his freedmen knew, he dismissed the rest of the household servants, giving out that he meant to kill himself with poison, and taking the two trusted men with him, went down into the underground chambers. To his wife, he sent his freedman Martialius to report that he had died by poison, and that the farmhouse had burned down together with his body. For he wanted to make use of his wife's genuine grief as proof of his supposed death, which indeed came about. For, throwing herself down just as she was, amid laments and wailing, she held out for 3 days and nights without food. When Sabinus learned of this and grew afraid that she would utterly destroy herself, he had Martialius tell her secretly that he was alive and in hiding, and that he begged her to persevere a little longer in her mourning, and to make her pretense convincing. So the rest of her performance was carried out by the woman in anguished keeping with the appearance of her grief. But longing to see him, she went off by night and came back again. From this point on, unbeknownst to everyone else, she came within a little of actually living with her husband in Hades itself, for more than 7 months running, during which time, having disguised Sabinus with a change of clothes, a haircut, and a covering for his head, she brought him, unrecognized, with her to Rome, on the strength of certain hopes that had been held out to her. But having achieved nothing, she went back again, and for the most part lived with him underground, though from time to time she would go up into the city to be seen by her women friends and relatives. And the most incredible thing of all, she managed to conceal that she was pregnant even while bathing with the other women, for the preparation with which women anoint their hair to make it golden and reddish contains a kind of oil that builds up the flesh, or loosens it, so as to produce a sort of swelling or distension. Using this liberally on the rest of her body, she hid the swelling of her belly, since it too rose and filled out along with the rest. Her labor pains she bore entirely alone, diving down to her husband as a lioness does into her den, and she reared the male cubs that were born to her, for she bore two. Of these sons, one fell and died in Egypt, while the other has only just recently been here among us at Delphi, a man named Sabinus. As for her, Caesar put her to death, but having killed her, he paid the penalty for it, since in a short time his whole line was utterly wiped out. For that reign produced nothing grimmer, and no other sight is likely to have turned away the eyes of gods and spirits more than that one. And yet her boldness and her lofty words took away the pity of those watching, words with which she provoked Vespasian most of all, once she had given up hope of survival, when she urged him to trade places with her, saying that she had lived more sweetly in the darkness underground than he had in ruling as king. At this point, my father said that their discourse on love came to an end, since they were now close to Thespiae, and that one of Pyges's companions, Diogenes, was seen approaching them at more than a walking pace. When Socles called out to him while he was still some way off, "Not news of war, I hope, Diogenes," the man answered. "Hush now, there is a wedding on, so keep quiet and come along faster, since the sacrifice is waiting for you." At this everyone was delighted, and Zeuxippus asked whether he was still being difficult. "Why, he has already given in to Ismenodora," Diogenes said, "and now, willingly taking up a garland and a white cloak, he is ready to lead the way through the marketplace to the god." "Well then, by Zeus, let us go," my father said. "Let us go, so that we may have our laugh at the man and pay our respects to the god, for it is plain that he is glad and that he looks favorably on what is being done."